Okay, the suggestion was that we talk tonight about choosing a marriage partner. Who here is married already? Okay, so it's too late for you, I'm afraid. But you're probably going to interfere with your children and grandchildren where they make their choices, so you might as well interfere right. So if you're married already, that'll be the purpose of this discussion. And if you're not, then it will be the correct way to find a victim. How do you find a suitable victim? I think the way to discuss this may be to give you a chance to ask questions. Maybe I'd be more able to address the issues that are particular concern to you. But first, give me a chance to build a picture of the subject as dictated by Torah guidelines and by practical experience, and see if we can get a sort of an overview of the issues. And then if you have questions on each particular component, I'd be happy to to answer if I can. First of all, by way of background, I presume you're aware that one ought to get married, right? You know that it's a Jewish thing to do. It's a mitzvah to get married. Actually, it is a man's mitzvah, not really a woman's mitzvah. A woman does not really have a primary commandment to get married. If she wants to put up with a male challenge, then she's free to do so. And of course, once she opts to do that, she takes on the man's mitzvah, right? She can't refuse intimacy or having a child, for example, on the grounds that it's uncomfortable or difficult or dangerous. She's then beholden in her husband's mitzvah. But she doesn't have to get into that in the first place. And if there's time, perhaps we can discuss a little bit about why that is true. But nevertheless, it is certainly a mitzvah for her if she does opt to do it, and it's certainly a mitzvah for a man. And therefore, that is we are talking about fulfilling that commandment, which is among the first, or the first commandment that's actually phrased in the Torah. And that's the concept. Now, the question I want to speak about more tonight is the process of choice. In other words, what are the criteria you look at? How do you know whether someone is suitable or not? Right? A lot of people have a lot of conflicting things they hear about it. What is important? What's not important? What sort of compatibility? What are the requirements in a marriage partner? How do you know that the requirements are there? How do you know the person isn't only presenting themselves in a way that isn't the way they genuinely are? There are many questions here. I think experience shows that you can make a hierarchy of criteria. You can make a list of criteria that need to be present or that need to be considered when you are considering marrying someone. And I would suggest to you that a logical way to do it is to understand that there are two non-negotiable criteria, and then there's a red line, and beneath the red line is a whole set of negotiable criteria. Now, let me just make that a bit clearer. When I say non-negotiable or negotiable, don't misunderstand me. Negotiable criteria don't mean things that are not important, by no means. I don't mean that at all. But I mean negotiable in the sense that these criteria are not going to be important to everyone. Whereas the two non-negotiables are standard things that if they're missing, you're going to be in real trouble. The negotiables are things that depend on you. For example, let me give you an example. You should marry somebody who's healthy. Right? Make sense? If you can? No? Make sense? But it's not an absolute requirement. There are people who have health issues. For example, I used to live in a certain place where I would see a young couple, and I would notice that almost every day an ambulance used to arrive at the apartment to take this young girl off for treatment. And a couple of years after they were married, she died. And when I went to see him, the young man, he told me that when they became engaged, she told him that she had terminal cancer, and he married her anyway. And he said it was the most wonderful 4 years of his life, and he's now looking to get married again. Now, not everybody could handle that, right? For him, it was wonderful and it worked, and he wanted to do that. And he was able to handle it, and they had a wonderful relationship. But not everybody could do that. So health is not an absolute criterion. If you're the kind of person that could not handle, or take, for example, another negotiable, so-called negotiable criteria, the young lady's mother. Young lady's mother, right? That is, I would, there's, I don't mean to suggest that that is an unimportant criterion. I just mean that it's negotiable. Some people are more sensitive to that sort of thing, right? there's a certain young man marries a girl whose mother is the type who needs a place to park her broom when she visits. Some young men could not handle that sort of situation. They need a very warm, loving, normal sort of family. And others would say, well, what's the difference? We'll go live in Alaska and we'll pull out the phone and, you know, it'll be okay. So that, I would say, is the girl's family, or the opposite party's family, I would say is negotiable, because it depends on your attitude, money, financial status, financial comfort and security, where you're going to live. I mean, there are many issues that are critical for some people and not critical for others. So when we draw the red line and we talk about negotiables, we're not talking about unimportant things. Is that clear? We're talking about things that are depend on your own personal, the impersonal importance that you give to these things in a justifiable fashion. Of course, there are many things on the list that are frivolous and ridiculous, and people focus on them in completely unbalanced fashion. I'm talking about things that are weighty and significant, but they have an individual meaning, and not everybody would agree that they are necessary. But above the red line, there are two things that are not negotiable. Those are pretty much essential things, and if one of those is missing, then don't come to me afterwards and say that, you know, you're in trouble. Let me just also make one more introductory comment, and that is, when we talk about two non-negotiables, I'm not talking about absolutes. Above the yeah, how's your imagination? See our blackboard? Here's a blackboard. We have a red line. Above the red line are two non-negotiable criteria, right? These two need to be there. But above these are absolute requirements, which I'm not even going to discuss this evening. When I say absolute, I mean things that are not, there's no way to debate those at all. For example, here's a young man wanting to get married. The first absolute requirement is that the potential partner should be female. That, I would say, is an absolute requirement. And it's not as frivolous as it sounds, because here, you know, in Britain a few weeks ago, they passed a law giving equal rights, marital rights, to same-sex couples, right? Actually enshrined in law. That, of course, is a major tragedy. The Talmud says that one of the three pervasive benefits or privileges, what do you call it, merits that the non-Jewish nations have had throughout history, one of the three unique merits that they've always had is that they never legalized same-sex marriages, even though they may have sort of condoned them and they may have been taking place, but to actually enshrine them in a legal system is a very great indictment of non-Jewish society, and unfortunately we are in that situation. But from a Jewish perspective, obviously we're talking about male, female, and therefore I'm not even talking about that this evening. That obviously is an absolute requirement. Another absolute requirement is that the parties are both Jewish, right? We're talking about Jewish marriage. You can't marry a non-Jew. You can't marry a non-Jew. You can have a fantastic relationship with a non-Jew. Why not? You can have a love and you can have a very successful relationship. You could live together for a lifetime. That's not the point. The point is that you can't have what's called kiddushin. Kiddushin means the unique Jewish sanctity that's involved in a Jewish marriage. This is not a question of bigotry or prejudice. We're not talking about superiority. We're talking about the necessary spiritual hooks that hook into each other to make what's called kiddushin. It's unique to Judaism, I think, that marriage is called a sanctification. The verb we use for betrothal, for marriage, actually means a sanctification. Even though marriage involves, among other components, an earthly physical component that many non-Jewish systems see as an area of guilt or perhaps a certain problematic light. In Judaism, all aspects of marriage are considered to be a sanctification. You can't do that between a Jew and a non-Jew. Again, don't misunderstand. Because it's not politically correct to say these things, or because it's not part of the liberal Western ethos, doesn't alter the fact that Jewishly, if you want to do what's called kiddushin, that means the Jewish marriage, which is the sanctification, that exists between two Jews. So I'm taking that as an absolute criterion as well. Of course, if a person converts to Judaism, then they're Jewish. There's no question about that. There's a mitzvah to love a convert even more than a person who's born Jewish and so forth. That's not really an issue. But we are talking about that as an absolute criterion. There are other absolute criteria too. For example, again, I don't want to spend too much time on this. What about a person who cannot have children? What about a young man who wants to get married and the girl, let's say, is known that she cannot have a child? That is problematic in Jewish law. The reason it's problematic is that the man's mitzvah is to have children, right? The format of the mitzvah of marriage, apart from the mitzvah of not being alone, which he fulfills by being married also, the criterion is also to have children, right? That's the mitzvah specifically. So if the girl can't have children, then there is a technical problem. The reason, of course, that we have a problem is that since it's our custom for a man to marry only one woman, right, whereas that was not the original biblical law, although it was by far the most common format for marriage, was that there was only one marriage partner. The Torah nevertheless did not outlaw, and the mystical reasons for this, why one man could marry many women, and why in fact one man might even want to marry many women, whereas no woman in her right mind, believe me, would want more than one husband. Why that is not the subject of tonight's discussion. But since a man could marry more than one wife, if he married a girl who couldn't have children, that wasn't halakhically problematic because he could marry another girl as well. For the last 8 or 9 centuries, it's been the law in the Ashkenazi world that we allow men to marry only one girl. If you're a Sephardi, by the way, any Sephardim here? If you're a Sephardi, then you can go right ahead and marry as many as you want. I would suggest you see me privately before you make that decision. Not such a simple matter. But in the Ashkenazi world, we have the practice of marrying only one. Now, if you're an Ashkenazi man, and pretty much for all practical purposes as Sephardi today also, if the girl that you're contemplating marrying, if it's known that you can't have children, then there's a technical problem because you'll not be able to fulfill the mitzvah of having children. What does one do in those circumstances? A fascinating discussion. Some time ago, a young girl came to see me who told me that she was born without ovaries, which means that she looks normal. She's been given hormones since she was a young girl. She's able to carry a pregnancy, but she can't conceive a pregnancy. She has a womb, so she could carry a pregnancy and give birth to a child, but she cannot conceive her own child. So she came to me and she said, look, I want to start a Jewish home and marry an observant young man. Am I allowed to tell him that we will use an egg donated from another woman and he will fertilize that egg and I'll carry the pregnancy? Because if you say I can, then I can get married. But if you say that I'm not allowed to do that, then who is going to marry me since he has a mitzvah of having children if we're not allowed to do that? Right? It's a very heart-wrenching question. That's not a simple matter. And although there are those in Jewish law who may allow surrogacy of that kind or egg donation or transplantation, the best way to handle that situation, which I was able to tell her, was that since there are a lot of problems with egg donation, and again, obviously this needs a full discussion, but there are a lot of problems. One of the significant problems, of course, is that when a woman has a child where the egg is donated by another woman, then one of the fascinating questions is, who's really the mother? Is it the genetic mother who contributes the egg that genetically is the origin of the child? Or is it the gestational mother, the one who carries the pregnancy? In fact, this is not a clear matter halakhically either. In Israel today, I don't know if you're aware of this, in Israel today the practice is to register both mothers as the legal mother. So a person like that grows up with two legal mothers, the one who gave the egg and the one who carries the pregnancy. And the reason, of course, they do that is they want to outlaw a marriage with siblings from either party. Since it's not clear who the real mother is in law, or in halacha for that matter, so the practice is to define both mothers as the legal mother, which means there'd be a prohibition on marrying siblings or half-siblings from either mother, which is probably a very sensible thing to do. So I was able to tell her that the preferable way to handle the situation is either to find a young man who himself cannot have children, because there's no reason why he shouldn't marry her, or a young man who has already been married and has children, and perhaps has lost his wife, in which case she fulfills the most amazing mitzvah of becoming the mother to children who are already in the world who need a mother. In fact, that is considered such a great mitzvah that the Talmud says that if a man's wife dies and he has little children, he's allowed to remarry in the first week of mourning for his wife. Of course, they're not allowed to live together because he's a mourner, but he's allowed to get married so that the children shouldn't be motherless. And she began to cry when I told her that, and she went out to try to find somebody in that situation where there are children, Jewish children in the world who need a mother, and she could become a mother to those children and fulfill the other mitzvahs of marriage. That's an option. So these are what I would call absolute criteria that we're not going to talk about this evening. They're not really issues of balance of judgment and choice. Those are issues of sort of the requirements of Jewish marriage. But let's move on, with your permission, to the two non-negotiable criteria. When it comes to choice, and you're talking about the two issues that need to be considered, what are the two things that I think experience shows you need to assess in order to know whether the person is suitable? The first one, the first of the non-negotiable criteria, the first thing you need to be sure is there is, what would you say?
Marriage
Attraction. Any other? Trust. I would put it first, yeah.
Torah observance.
Well, that's a good point. Torah observance, common goals on that level, you might actually call an absolute requirement. If you're not on the same way, one observant person marrying somebody who's not good, those are required. We have a lot, unfortunately, a rich experience of people on different religious levels and the amazing conflict that causes. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be on exactly the same level. And this is a fascinating discussion in the Baal Teshuva world where people, the real conflict we enter most times is people who are already married, and then one becomes more religiously motivated and knowledgeable. Another one feels, I didn't marry you under those circumstances. Why am I forced into this whole religious thing? That's a very well-known issue. But most, in terms of choosing a partner, our experience shows that even if they're not on the same level, but they're moving in the same direction. In other words, anyone with any sense religiously knows that give me any day a person on step one who's moving up, okay, strongly, than a person on step 10 who's not interested and is stagnant, right? That's not... And this is a whole fascinating discussion about different levels on the religious. But let's talk this evening, assuming that both parties are committed to Jewish law. Let's even call that an absolute criterion. Now, I think experience shows that the first thing that needs to be assessed is natural attraction. Natural attraction, what we call chen, the chemistry. Chemistry, that involves a physical attraction. It involves a natural... That means the pleasure in being together with a person are not on a logical level. It's not something you can stipulate a recipe for. But it's something that people find each other attractive because of a question of taste. It very often has cultural and family components. The background and the genesis of this outlook and this question of taste is not really important for now. What is important is that there needs to be a rich sense of attraction to the person. Why we put this first is not because it's the most important thing in marriage, but I think it's probably of the two non-negotiable items, it's probably the easiest to assess, right? The other things on the list are a little harder to get beneath the veneer and discover the truth about the person, whereas question of chen, of attraction, of chemistry, let's call it chemistry, it is a question of after meeting a few times, you can be pretty clear about whether that's there, right? If you meet the person, I wouldn't say necessarily the first time. Sometimes you meet a person, they don't appeal to your preconceived notions of attraction necessarily. But after you meet a person a few times, 3, 4, 5 times, if you still don't feel any sense of pleasure at being with a person, a natural connection, a chemistry, then that, of course, is a sign that, this is a real issue. Now, there are a number of things that need to be said about this thing called chen or attraction or chemistry or whatever you want to call it. The first thing is, of course, that to note that it's a religious requirement, right? It's not just good advice and sort of experience. The Talmud actually says that this thing needs to be there. For example, there's a very strong opinion in the Talmud that a man should not marry a woman without seeing her first. He needs to see her because she needs to appeal to him, right? Marriage can be difficult at the best of times, and she needs to appeal to him, and in order for that to be there, he needs to have seen her first. Interestingly, the Talmud does not consider it as essential for the woman to see the man. That means that the Gemara says that women have a much more mature sense of the value of marriage anyway, and, or put it another way, they're prepared to put up with more, or put up with less, maybe one should say, and therefore they are more mature about their sense of the value of marriage, and they put less emphasis on, the externalities, and they value marriage more maybe. But nevertheless, it's good advice on both sides that there's an attraction. The second point to note is that this is very often misunderstood in the so-called Baal Teshuva world. People who are not from a religious background and become much more observant and get very enthusiastic and excited about it, very often you have the phenomenon that people who choose that become extreme. And one of the spectra on which they tend to become extreme is to value spiritual things and to devalue very much things that they associate with a secular history, background, outlook, etc., right? In other words, physical attraction is something that they feel not a very religious thing, and therefore it gets downplayed in their eyes, and that's a mistake. I mean, I remember a young man who came to see me once. He was a friend of mine. We in yeshiva together. A very charming, good-looking South African fellow. And he said to me, he's dating a certain young lady. Can we talk about it? I said, sure. He went and sat down on the grass, and he started to tell me about this girl. She was absolutely fantastic. I mean, she was highly intelligent and spiritually elevated in the way she said Tehillim. And, by that, she could have been Mrs. Mashiach. I mean, she was really... So he told me all about this girl's wonderful qualities. And then at the end of this discussion, his voice trailed off into silence, and I said to him, do you like her? And he said, no. And I said, you know, here's a fellow who, you know, I gave him a very sharp, you know, talking to, and I gave him very clear instructions to go and behave the way he used to behave on the Durban beachfront when he was young, although, you know, clean it up a bit, of course. But, I mean, you know, he's a charming young man who had a very rich sense of the natural aspects of relationship, and because he becomes so religiously inspired, he began to think that all those things are irrelevant, and of course they're not irrelevant at all, and therefore this is a very important element of the question of choice. Let me point out to you an amazing thing here, and that is that this happens to be, you see, people often come to this discussion with a secular background, and they think that this religious approach to things is very artificial. The whole shidduch system where people are suggested for each other and there's like a sort of a arrangement that's made before they meet, you know, and that's very artificial. You should note that this system is actually a very feminist system, right? For example, in classic feminism, you'll often hear women say, express the theme, that they want to be appreciated and loved as entire people, right? Not just as objects, so to speak. But if you think about it for a moment, you'll realize that what the secular world does is puts very great emphasis on presenting women as objects, right? They're presented in the secular world in a very provocative fashion. That is the norm, unfortunately, in our generation. You just have to walk in the street and see what's, or perhaps better not to see, what is out there in the street, in, particularly in the summer. Women are presented in a very provocative fashion, and very often a man's first his attention is first drawn by the physical. What's very interesting to note is that in the religious world, where the relationship is predicated on religious values, it's a very feminist position. For example, a woman has to be feminine in her, she's not allowed to wear men's clothing, right? So she has to be dressed in a feminine fashion. Secondly, she has to be dressed modestly. So wouldn't dream of presenting herself as in a physically provocative fashion. Thirdly, before marriage in Jewish law, there's no contact at all. Absolutely zero contact, which means that what many women express as their desire to be appreciated on all levels has to take place, because the relationship cannot be immediately sublimated into a physical relationship, which very often is, especially in the modern world where women have allowed themselves to be put into that situation. Women have to understand, it's an important thing to know, is that women have to understand they've allowed themselves to be put into a situation in relationships today where they've deprived men of all motivation to get married. Why should a young man want to get married nowadays? He already has, in a premarital relationship, he already has all the privileges with none of the obligations. What on earth should make him want to get married? Do you see the problem? Men have taken advantage of that situation and women have allowed it to happen. It's a tragedy. In Jewish law, it isn't like that. In Jewish law, the attitude is, if you want me, then you get all the privileges and all the obligations for the rest of our lives, right? It's a complete giving. Not a question of... Unfortunately, in the secular world today, men's attitude is that marriage brings only obligations. It doesn't bring any new privileges. My wife and I were dealing with a young couple where they met when they were 18, just as they left school, and they lived together like most young couples do these days for 11 years. When she was 29, she mentioned marriage and he disappeared. Disappeared. Marriage? She wasn't thinking of marriage. Like, who spoke about marriage, right? So she gave the 11 best years of her life in the trust that this would lead to a marriage that was never discussed, and when they discussed marriage, he disappeared, right? So that, of course, is not the Jewish system. Amazingly, it turns out to be, this old-fashioned religious system turns out to be very respectful from a feminist point of view. The woman is seen in a feminine fashion, but the intimacy and the fullness of that relationship is reserved. So therefore, a man has to consider his potential wife before marriage in a total fashion. She has to be attractive, of course, that's very important. They have to meet and spend time together. On the other hand, he has to actually speak to her. Not just to speak to her. And of course, in the menstrual separation phase of marriage, we continue that. During menstrual separation, the mode of marriage is, again, not to sublimate the relationship into physicality, but there's a time for actually relating to each other on another level. So it's a very intense strengthening of both aspects of relationship. That's one question. Another question I often get asked is, if there's no physical relationship before marriage, how do we know we'll be compatible? That's a real concern. It's a real concern for people who've had a very secular background, right, and have had many previous relationships. It's a real concern. I usually answer by showing that a little examination of the facts will show you how mistaken that notion usually is. And the facts are obvious. The facts are that in a secular world where the relationship is fully explored before marriage, in fact, as I pointed out, most couples these days getting married have actually lived together for a long time, there, compatibility is absolutely assured. because a couple have been living together. And yet the current divorce rate is more than 1 in 2 in the secular West. In fact, in California now, it's quoted as about 2 in 3. And California is a place where not many people get married in the first place. So you have to think they really must want to when they get married. I'm ashamed to tell you that even in South Africa now, in the Jewish community, the divorce rate is something like 1 in 2. And that's a very stable, old-fashioned community where people are about as good as you can get. Nevertheless, there still is a very high divorce rate. So in the secular world where there's no problem of compatibility, the divorce rate's very high. In the so-called ultra-Orthodox world, where there's zero testing of compatibility beforehand, where people have no contact at all, the divorce rate, and I can tell you, speaking as a doctor who spent many years working intimately in the ultra-Orthodox community and in the secular community, the divorce rate and the rate of genuine unhappiness in marriage and non-functionality in marriage is very, very small. It is tragically rising. There's no question in the Orthodox world, the rate of divorce and marital disharmony and many other problems are rising and are rising alarmingly, but they're still an infinitesimally small percentage of what they are in the secular world. Of course, this is a very superficial analysis. The reason why there's such compatibility and why intimacy and other elements of marriage work so well in the religious world is not only because, I mean, there are so many sociological factors and so many psychological and cultural factors. The very fact that a couple getting married in the religious world have no comparisons to make, right? That means if they've lived a religious lifestyle, they lived in the Orthodox world, so then they won't have any. In the secular world, a young man getting married today often has so many comparisons with so many relationships he's had before that no living woman could possibly live up to all the comparison. Because don't forget, he extracts the best of each relationship and he compares this poor woman, right, to the total of the best that he's ever experienced on all the relationships that he's had before. It makes it almost impossible. Whereas in the religious world, you don't have that. And of course, the more, you know, you can't force yourself into that mold. If you're born in Meir Sharim in Yerushalayim and you marry a girl from Geula, you know, in many ways, this young man knows that the girl's going to be just like his mother, and she knows he's going to be just like his father in many important ways. There's guaranteed cultural compatibility. The family's been davening in the same shul for the last 450 years. You know, there's so much compatibility that's set up before they get together. Yeah, I'll tell you a story that may interest you. This story's not for you, okay? It's not for you. Don't get confused. I'm just telling you out of sociological interest. The person I know who grew up in Meir Sharim, in what you would definitely call the ultra-Orthodox community. I'm talking about long pears, long black frock, you know, real ultra-Orthodox. This is how he got married. He said that when he was 18, one day his father walked into the house and said, Nochem, put on your Shabbos clothes. So he said, why, Abba? So his father said, never mind, just put on your Shabbos clothes. So he got dressed in his Shabbos outfit. His father walked him across into a house in Geula. And as they walked into the house, his father said, Nochem, say hello to your kala. Say hello to your fiance. So he said, hello. And they all said, Mazel Tov. And the men had a party in one room. The women had a party in another room. On his way out, his father took him out and said, say goodbye to your kala. He said, goodbye. His father said, no, not to her. He said, oh, goodbye. And that was the only time they saw each other before getting married. That was the engagement. The next time they saw each other was under the chuppah. The rest of the story is also interesting, and the story ends like this, that they were married actually for a few years, unable to have children, and they went at the time to see the Chazon Ish, the famous Chazon Ish, the leader of Torah Jewry in Bnei Brak at the time, and the Chazon Ish gave them a brocha for Chai Bonim Chaim. He gave them a blessing that they should merit to have 18 living children, and a few years ago they had their 19th. Okay, now that is not for you. Not the children. 19 children is fine. You should definitely strive to have 19 children. But the question of that sort of a courtship and a engagement, that's not for most of us. People who come from a secular background need a lot more. That's fraught with danger, that sort of a... And therefore, the point here, of course, is that the cultural background makes an enormous difference, so you can't pretend to compare, and it's a mistake when the Baal Tshuva compares himself in areas that are not appropriate. But nevertheless, this is the discussion. And finally, of course, the question in this criterion of attraction, the question that it raises is, how attractive? How attractive does a person have to be? You know, that we're talking about physical attraction, chemistry. How attractive does the person have to be? Do you have to look at them and sort of get, you know, life-threatening asthma? You know, is that like, does it have to be that exciting? Or, you know, is mild breathlessness enough? You know, well, I think that it's clear that mild breathlessness is enough. In other words, we're talking about somebody who, I would say that in this area of attraction, there is also a red line. The red line is the line of neutrality. In other words, the kind of feeling when you're with a particular individual, they don't move you either way. You don't feel very attracted to them. On the other hand, you don't feel in any way that they're offensive. That is not good. It needs to be better than that. How much better is not so important. Any physical relationship, physical attraction, those things redefine themselves after marriage anyway. They fall into place in a different sort of a fashion. The criteria become different as people age and times change. But the important thing is that there is a positive feeling, a positive chemistry. Many young men make a mistake in this area. They find themselves with a young woman who is attractive, but they keep thinking maybe there's somebody who's going to be more attractive. That many men put off marriage for years because they think that they deserve absolutely, you know, they of course are perfect. And therefore they convinced that the most perfect woman in the world is going to come knocking on their door. And so every girl they're with, they think, well, she's very nice, but, you know, there's probably somebody better. And of course I deserve, you know, the best. So that of course is a mistake. We're not talking about somebody who's necessarily the most attractive. After all, no one's a perfect package, even you. Are not a perfect package, and if you're waiting for the girl who has all the maximum marks in all the departments, it's probably unrealistic. And therefore, we are talking about a positive attraction, even if it isn't sort of a dangerous asthma that, you know, strikes you every time you think about it. So that is a question of positive attraction. Of course, one should not forget that this needs to be on both sides too. It isn't only the man who needs to find the woman attractive. It also needs to be that she needs to find him. And in each side, you have different types of problems and immaturities. Men often, young men often can be very fixated on certain things. I mean, many young men have come and said to me, look, she's a very attractive girl, but there's one feature, there's this detail, there's that detail, you know. This is a very difficult area. When a young man says that to you, and you need a very careful warning here for people who work in the marital field, counseling or suggesting matches, people like that often make the mistake of saying, look, that's immature, don't worry, it'll be okay. And sometimes the people don't have the maturity and it's not okay. Sometimes the person is so immature that when they define a problem and you push them into the marriage, all they see is the problem. One young man came to me and he said, he just got married and my wife and I knew the young girl. She was absolutely lovely, a wonderful young girl, wonderful in all ways, very attractive as well. He's having trouble in the marriage. Why? She doesn't look like his mother. She doesn't look like his mother. He wanted to marry a girl who looked like his mother and like she doesn't look like his mother. I mean, that is very immature. So why did you marry her? Because the advisor, he had a certain trusted advisor, and the advisor said to him, look, you're being immature, don't worry, after you marry, it'll be okay. Well, he wasn't mature enough, and after they get married, it wasn't okay. So for 6 months, he used to come and see me, he's put his head down on my desk and cry, and after 6 months, they got divorced. Right? Now that is not... on the other hand, you can't push someone into that, because this is something that if a person is... You know, if they see a certain thing and it strikes them as problematic and they build it up as a sort of an obsession, then it's going to be a real feature. Even though you can see objectively it's not, you can't force someone into that. Obviously, they have to make their own judgments. And therefore, it's a policy, it should be a policy never to force somebody or press them or tell them that things will be okay when they may not be okay. I mean, you do get exceptions. We had one young man we were dealing with who had trouble getting married, but only because it was absolutely clear that he had a personal issue. It wasn't that the girl was wonderful and he said she was wonderful, it was clear she was wonderful. But he lived for many years only with his mother, who was very close to her, and 3 weeks before his marriage, he started lying in bed in the fetal position, you know, trembling, you know, with fear for hours on end. Well, it was clear that his problem wasn't the girl, it was just, you know, his own. And we actually carried him to the chuppah. We carried him, right? And we sort of held him up under the chuppah. Anyway, he's been very happily married for a number of years. And that turned out fine. But it's a rare circumstance where you can feel that confident that it's going to be okay, because people need to make their own judgments. Of course, on the woman's side, there also needs to be an attraction. Okay, here's this young man. He's 18 years old, and he's dating for the first time. You know he's dating because he's wearing a clean shirt for the first time in 18 years, and he starts smelling like a flower. Well, you know he's dating when that happens. And he's paying a lot of attention to his looks. Then what happens is he gets married, and after he gets married, sort of doesn't pay that much attention, you know, to his looks and his physique and his fitness. That's not respectful in marriage. One needs to, also a Jewish woman needs to know, of course, that marriage is the place to focus on. See, in the secular world, very often women have completely the wrong concept. What they do in the secular world very often is the secular world encourages a woman to look very good when she's out, right? She's very good on the street, absolutely ravishing. But at home, she looks like something the cat dragged in. That, you know, that is not a respectful way to treat your husband. The Jewish woman should look on the street, she should look decent and feminine and elegant and refined, and at home she should look more attractive. It's exactly the opposite. By the way, there's a reason for that. The reason that many women are looking more attractive when they're out than they are at home is unfortunately because many men have a very serious immaturity in this area. Many men, if you scratch beneath the surface, if you speak to this young man who's dating and you find that he doesn't find the woman attractive enough, if you scratch beneath the surface, very often you'll find it's not really bothering him. What's really bothering him is what his friends are going to think. Right? It's not, she doesn't bother him, it's what his friends are going to think about how attractive she is. See, men can be very immature in this area. If he were alone on a desert island with this lady, she'd be absolutely fine, I can assure you. But it's because he's going to have to sort of display her in public, you know, that he wonders if he's going to, if she's going to be good enough. So these are particular immaturities, and they, unfortunately, they can be real. So that is a summary, I would say, of the question of natural attraction. Are there any questions in this area before we move on? Yeah.
Just quickly, what you were saying there about, say the guy does find the girl attractive, and that's all happy, and the girl does change from whatever way, and it could be he might be viewing her as a trophy, but she meets those trophy requirements, and then the trophy requirements do change.
Right. Well, that is inevitable, but the concept we. Well, I think the assumption is that people will change after marriage. You're going to get older. You look different when you're pregnant than when you're not. Right? These are well-known things.
How are you know the person you're dating is mature enough to handle that?
Oh, I see. That's the problem. I see. Okay, that will come not under the question of attraction, but under the question of assessment of character and maturity.
Right.
So we'll get there in a moment. Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, any other questions? Straightforward? Clear? You don't have to take it, you know... On trust, you can argue. Okay, so that I think is a summary of the first criterion, and I said we put it first because it may be easier to assess than what comes next. The next criterion on the chart, which is the second non-negotiable above the red line, is probably the most important thing about a person altogether, and that is? Yeah, I would say it is raw character. In other words, the person themselves. We're talking about, you could call it Midas, you could call it character, personality. We're not talking about compatibility or intelligence or academic, you know, abilities or talent. We're talking about the raw human material. Basically, what you're looking for, the default position, again, not everybody has this and not everybody has their own features that could mesh in this fashion. We have to talk about that. But what you're talking about as a basis is a person who is kind, good, affectionate, giving, gentle, loving, a person who knows how to cope, who knows how to smile, above all else a giver. If the person is the opposite, they are psychopathic, twisted, hung up, problematic, depressed, and grasping, then you are in trouble unless you are psychopathic, twisted, hung up, and then you'll be fine. I mean, which reminds me of the story of the sadist and the masochist who got married. Do you know the story? A sadist and a masochist got married. Perfect, right? So as soon as the door closed, they were alone. The masochist said to the sadist, "Hurt me." And the sadist said, "No." Okay, anyway. Be that as it may. There's no substitute for good character. Right? A person at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're in pain and money's tight and things are difficult, what comes through is a person who knows how to cope. A person who's balanced, who knows how to cope, who's not hung up, who's not tense, a person who's above all else a giver. Right? That probably sums it up. Marriage is about giving. Rav Dessler says in a famous analysis that love is the result of giving, not receiving. You don't love where you receive. It just makes you love yourself more and want to receive more. Loving is where you give. That's why parents always love their children more than the children love their parents. Always. Because the giving goes in that direction. You love where you give. And marriage is about giving. If you're dealing with a person who is kind, gentle, sweet, unaffected, a person who knows how to cope, a person who is above all else a giver, then that two people trying to give to each other are absolute recipe for bliss. Two people trying to take from each other, right, each one is concerned that the other one make me happy, that is a recipe for civil war. The Jewish formula, this is an important theme to talk about in marriage altogether, you need to listen to the tapes on, I have two tapes on marriage, right, or CDs. One's called Marriage 1, Mystical and Practical, and Marriage 2 is The Role of Woman. Those tapes go into the theory behind the love that's involved in marriage, and we can't go into all of that discussion now, but I suggest to you that you listen to those two CDs. The men need to listen to the first one at least monthly, okay? At least monthly, just to remind yourself. But those tapes are try to summarize that information. But marriage is about giving, and if you're dealing with a person who is naturally a giver, then you are, that is a recipe for success. So again, what you're looking for is somebody who is kind, gentle, sweet, basically a normal South African. Now, if you are, that is the question. Now, obviously, not everybody can mesh with that. Some people do have, people have a lot of baggage. Some people have a lot of baggage, and they've got issues and psychological issues. That's okay. But you need to be sure that the person, that there's a compatibility. That means you can cope with that person's issues if they, right, if they have a particular baggage or areas or issues, that you have the compensatory mechanisms that you can actually cope with. There's no reason why it shouldn't be a wonderful relationship. But be that as it may, the most important thing I would say to assess about the person is their personality, their character in itself. Not tastes and compatibilities, and they like Italian food and you'd like, you know, Norwegian food, and you know, they like it, you know, classical music, and you like underground purple rap, whatever it is. You know, although I couldn't imagine marrying someone like. But anyway, the point is that those aren't the important things. The important things are the actual personality. And people get so hung up on the details, on compatibilities and tastes and all sorts of peripheral issues, that they completely miss the most important thing, which is the actual person underlying. Now, of course, that leads to a couple of questions. One is, how do you know that the person is that? And how do you know that they are good and kind? When people present themselves in the beginning of a relationship, they don't necessarily, the first time they meet you, tell you about all their hang-ups. And I mean, some people do, and of course, and that's a great pleasure, because meet them again. But most people sort of, you know, they may put on a face of much more respectable and positive face, and you may only discover later that there are certain dark lurking secrets. So how do you assess the person? So here there are a few standard elements that should be borne in mind. The background is extremely important. A person's family and a person's background, their personal history, in other words, is very, very important. We are all products of our families and our cultures. Even if you think you've rebelled against it, so then you're a product by having rebelled. Right? We are all basically products. We all carry with us our families and our cultures. That's not a bad thing, but that is the basic material with which we work. And the person's background is very important. What's their family story? What's their personal story? Do they have long-term dedicated friendships? You know, have they got long, stable, you know, loyalty to friends? That's a very important thing. A person who doesn't have that, who's got a fractured personal background, personal story, these are very important things. Unfortunately for many people, the family is important. You know, I would say that when you're dating someone, at some point you need to visit their home. You know, you can tell an awful lot from visiting the home. Let's say you step into the house and you find there's blood on the walls, you know, and human bones in the corner and sort of sharp objects. You know, that doesn't bode well, you know, for them. On the other hand, if you meet a person whose parents are still happily married and their family's intact and their children are sort of more or less, the rest of the children are more or less sane, and, you know, there's no obvious sort of violence or witchcraft or that sort of thing going on, that speaks very well about the person. Of course, this raises the problem, what do you do when you meet somebody who is very good and kind and nice and they have a problematic background? So here you have to be very careful. It's been shown many times in psychiatric and sociological research that people tend to follow the patterns of their parents, or rather to have the same issues to deal with, right? That's a very well-known thing. And it's also been shown that trauma that occurs to children when they're young, for example, the death of a parent or divorce of parents, or major trauma in their lives, has a different meaning when it occurs when they're young than when it occurs when they're older. A person whose family breaks up or they lose a parent when they're 15 or 16 or 17, very often it doesn't have the same effect as it does when a child's 3 or 4 or 5. A little girl whose father dies or leaves when she's 5 or 6 or 7 may have trouble trusting men for the rest of her life, or trusting Hashem for that matter. So these are very important issues. Now, sometimes you find a person who's been through that sort of trauma and it comes out very much strengthening them. Right, a person who's been through difficulty and they've come out stable and knowing how to handle things, often that is extremely good, and it often works in the opposite direction. I would say a classic example of that, we've seen time and again, is a person who comes from a very difficult background, an extremely difficult background, and they themselves have become religious. What often happens in that setting is a story like this. The person has a family background that generates tremendous frustration, anger, resentment, bitterness. And suddenly when they become more religiously defined, instead of seeing their parents with anger and bitterness, they start to see them with pity. They start to see their parents in the following light. If only they would have had more Torah background and education, they would have gotten on much better. There would have been all the respect that was necessary. And it's a tragedy that their parents didn't know more about Judaism because of what it would have done for their personalities and their marriages. At that point, instead of seeing the past with bitterness and letting it eat away at them in terms of anger and frustration, they start to see it with sadness. And at the same time, instead of seeing themselves defined by their families, they model themselves on a religious couple. And I can think of examples where people have actually chosen a particular, I'm thinking one particular family, that dozens of young people in a particular place that I can think of, dozens of young people actually modeled their development and their marriages on a particular family that they admired in the religious community, that hosted them and took them in, and very often they stayed there. It was an exemplary family and marriage and child-raising experience. So they now redefine their goals and what a perfect marriage should be based on their perception of the religious world and religious criteria, people that impress them in that environment, and they're completely different in their outlook and very much more mature because they had a difficult background. So obviously, these are all very general comments, but that's important. So one issue is the background, and that's why in the question of introducing people to each other, we like to have some sense of the background, the family story, and you know, those influences. The second thing, of course, is you need to spend enough time with a person. Right? If you come from a secular Western background like ours, and you date once or twice or three times, with notable exceptions, that can be very problematic. It takes longer for most of us with secular backgrounds to get to know, to really explore and get to feel who the other person really is. How long does it take? Well, that's a difficult thing to say. Rabbi Gottlieb says he always tells the boys in the yeshiva at least 8 months. 8 months of dating. He says no one ever listens, so he says 4 months. Okay, well, they probably don't listen to that either. But the point is that there needs to be enough time spent with a person that you actually get to know who they are. I would say that there's another criterion you can apply as well. It isn't only an absolute period of time. It's a point where you reach in a relationship where you know the person so well that you know that another meeting is not going to yield new information. That's a very clear point in a relationship. You get to a certain point where you know the person, you know their attitudes, you know their responses, you know that another date is not going to yield any new information about the person. At that moment is the time to get engaged or to split. Because from there on in, it's just going to be more painful, it's going to be more emotional engagement, it's going to be harder to separate. There's no reason to continue beyond that point. Is this clear? You know, if I took anyone in this room and I said, what would your father say in the following circumstance? And I described some little vignette to you. Everybody in this room would be able to tell me your father's response exactly down to the very words he would use, right? Because you know him. When you get to know a person in that to that extent, you know them, you know their responses, you know how they feel about things, you genuinely know how they respond in all sorts of circumstances, there's just no point in continuing to date anymore. You've got all the information, right? On the other hand, if you haven't reached that point and you don't know all their attitudes, and then you get married and you discover that you want 25 children and she wants to be sterilized, you know, that is... That's problematic, right? That actually happened to a friend of mine, believe it or not. A friend of mine married a girl in California. And after they got married, it turned out that she had one child and had had herself sterilized after one child. Can you imagine? And he found out only after. First of all, can you imagine the conscience of a doctor who does that to him? Anyway, they got married, and a few months later she left. She said she needed to find her freedom, and she headed for the hills. So that was the end of that marriage. But the point is that... you have to get an understanding of each other. So once you know each other's attitudes and you know, and this helps to see a person under different circumstances. If you see them only in the sort of artificial dating situation, it's a little bit more difficult. You need to see them under different circumstances. Put them under a little bit of pressure, right? Get them to come and visit you at home and have your kid brother spill hot soup in their lap. That's a nice test of how they respond under those sorts of circumstances. Get your dog to bite them. Get someone to close the door on their fingers rather hard from time to time. You know, that sort of thing brings out a lot of, you know, genuine character. And if you do that, you'll get a good feel for who the person is and how they're going to respond to, you know, distress. But once you get to the point where you feel you really know the person, then, of course, it's absolutely pointless to continue torturing yourself and just schlepping on and on and on. It just causes frustration and it's an artificial situation. There's absolutely no reason to do that. So that is a summary, I would say, of the question of genuine personality and the time that it takes to assess it. And that brings us to the red line of issues that are negotiable. Before we get onto that, are there any questions about this discussion. Yes, please.
You were talking about backgrounds before. How do you trust someone if they say they've worked through their background and come out for the better? How do you know, and vice versa, how will they know about you?
Yeah, I would say that is a good question. How do you know whether a person has really come to the point of maturity that they seem to be presenting? You never know. You never know. At the end of the day, it's going to be your judgment, right? If they're warning signs, they've been through difficult stuff, or they've had their own personal difficult stuff, there are some objective things. There's some well-known medical or psychological issues that we have a pretty good handle on what their natural history is. But very often, it's going to be a question of judgment, and it's going to take time. What else is there? By the way, a person who doesn't have stuff in the background, also, how do you know they genuinely are, how they're presenting themselves, right? The background's important because it tells you about the stability and the history and how they've coped with, you know, with many things. But in the end of the day, it's going to be a question of judgment. And if it takes a little bit more time, then spend a bit more time. You know, there's no absolute formula for this, I'm afraid. Yeah.
What sort of questions and background are you looking for? So if someone's parents are divorced, then what else are you going to sort of turn around to someone to say? Have you been depressed? Have you been?
Yes, that's very important, of course. But that will come out. If you get to know a person
then
you
should not be with someone because they've had depression?
It depends what kind of depression. If they've been depressed and worked through it, they could be strengthened because of that.
Yeah.
But if they're morbidly depressed at present, can you handle that? You know, if they are actively psychologically abnormal at the moment, they're going through a clinical depression, okay, they're on medication and getting therapy, that's a very significant thing. Now, this doesn't mean they're not suitable to marry. They might be wonderful.
Yeah.
But it's a real fact today. Their parents were divorced when they were 10 in a very acrimonious and bitter battle that the children were deeply, you know, traumatized by. How have they handled that, right? You don't need to judge them negatively because of that, but it's a life circumstance that brought out a certain aspect of them. How did they handle that? What has been the result? They may be very strengthened and may have made a decision they'll never do that sort of thing in their lives, you know. So, but these are real factors in their background. Yes, please.
How many people should you be dating perhaps at the same time?
Are you a Sephardi?
Half.
Which half?
My mother.
Wrong. Okay. The question was how many people should be dating at the same time. That is out of the question. Out of the question. Right? One thoroughly at a time. Yeah? Is that clear? One. Yeah. Again, what sort of training is it for marriage to be sort of juggling women? You know, that's not the way you do it. If she's worth dating, she's worth dating exclusively. Are you with me? How can you build a relationship and a potential trust and are moving towards opening up with each other when you are superficially juggling girls, right? Don't do that. Don't do it. Yes, please.
How does a person actually know when they're ready for marriage?
Altogether. You mean not whether the other person's ready?
Yeah,
whether you are mature enough?
Yeah.
You ready? That's, again, a thing that you need to assess. You need to know your own maturity. There is an absolute criteria. There's a criteria, and that is when you've reached a certain level of your own. There's a certain definition of self that you've achieved, that you ought to know about. You should listen to my tape on defining one's role in life, closing the circle, self-definition. Right? That's a very important step. But I'll tell you an interesting thing. A certain young girl, very talented, very, very unusual, very talented. The fact that she's my daughter is not really relevant. But the point is that. When she finished her seminary training, she went to Gateshead Seminary, and when she was at that age, she came to me and she said, "Abba, I'm ready to get married. Find me a victim," right? So she was very clear. She was ready to get married. She wanted to get married. She asked me to look for somebody suitable to get married. So I went to my Rebbe, and I said to him, "My daughter is so-and-so age, and she feels ready to get married, and I'd like to..." He said, "No, not yet." And I was absolutely amazed. You're talking about a very, you know, great man in Torah, where the ideal is to get married very young. The Gemara says if you'd be married at 14, you'd be untouchable. The Gemara says you get married at 14. 18 is the latest you should try to get married. 18, definitely. The Gemara says if a man gets married when he's 18, he's fine. If he gets married when he's 16, even better. Get married when he's 14, he'd be absolutely pure. So like, you know, a religious teacher is going to tell you she shouldn't get married yet. He said to me, she needs to go out into the world and assert her own personality. She shouldn't think marriage is simply to be an empty echo of somebody else who's probably also just an empty echo at that time. That's not a relationship. A relationship isn't that you're somebody else's other half. A relationship is that you bring your own content to this relationship. And she hasn't asserted that yet. She was very talented. She had a lot of ability to be a very gifted teacher. And she was about to start her first teaching job. He said, let her go out and assert herself and develop herself in that. Then she'll have something to give in a relationship and not just be an amazing thing. And she did that. And she spent a number of months in teaching, very talented at that. And she very much expressed herself on her own. She clarified for herself her own set of talents and direction. And she met somebody who was absolutely perfect in terms of that definition of roles and needs. And it was just one of those. I learned a very important lesson from that. That it isn't necessarily somebody who is young and unformed. Although that can work and they can help form each other as they go. But a person who's got a certain level of maturity of self-definition, old enough to take care of themselves in a mature way, then they can start thinking about giving to somebody else. Yeah, any other questions about these issues, these points? No, nothing? Okay, now, let's just talk briefly about some of the negotiables. And I just want to mention some that are really issues that people think are important and are often misunderstood to be important. For example, a common question we get asked is intelligence. Right? I need somebody who is intelligent. Very often they put it at the top of their list. Intelligence, if you mean academic intelligence, is almost irrelevant, in my opinion and in my experience. In fact, very often it's probably a big disadvantage. There are people, look around you, you'll find people with two PhDs in, you know, quantum, you know, mechanics, whose personal lives are absolute shambles. And there are people with no academic qualification who are just wise in relationships. They just know what to say, they've got wisdom in their hands, they just know how to conduct relationships, right? So academic intelligence is not a requirement in terms of medicine. There's a more emotional type of intelligence, there's a wisdom, a life wisdom, what we call Chochmas Chaim, there's a life wisdom that is invaluable. But academic intelligence is not. Despite that, many people will tell you, yes, but I have to respect him. You know, somebody I have to be able to have intelligent discussions with, intellectual discussions with. Well, if you need it as a question of looking up to the person and respecting him, they have to be intelligent, that's okay. But very often it's a misjudgment. A man tells me, I need a girl who's very intelligent, you know, very high-level discussions. Believe me, from the day you get married, you never have a high-level intellectual discussion ever again. Ever again. First of all, you're just too darn tired. Secondly, you already know what she thinks about, you know, nuclear disengagement and the Warsaw Pact and, you know, all that. I mean, who on earth talks to their husband or wife at a high-level intellectual stuff? It's just like irrelevant, you know. And therefore, it's often a miss. It's often a misperception. If it's a question of how you see their personality and how you respect them, then it may be important. But academic intelligence as such, as an absolute criteria, really often is overblown, in my opinion. People think that compatibility of taste is important, and really it's not. The fact that you like different types of music or different types of activities, or that's not really important. The important thing is the mutual respect for each other's interests and areas. That's wonderful. But you don't have to like necessarily the same sort of literature, the same sort of... I know one marriage where a fantastic marriage, many years married, the man likes the most action-packed sort of literature you can imagine, total action, and the woman likes Russian novels. Now, you know, Russian novels take about 40 pages for the hero to get out of bed in the morning. Like, you know, total opposite, you know, tastes in literature, music, sport, just about anything. They're a wonderful marriage. In fact, the best marriage I ever saw in my life, probably, was a marriage in which I think the two parties had nothing in common at all. You know that? The husband was a totally logical, mathematical engineer who, even in the most screamingly panic-stricken situations, only thought logically. And the woman, I'm not sure, ever had a logical thought. She was the type who was completely artistic and emotional, and they had the most amazing marriage. Right? Why? Because they had amazing respect for each other's areas, never intruded on each other's area. By the way, the Talmud says that in marriage, you have to have a different definition of authority. You know that? There's a definition of authority. In what's called mili d'shmaya, that means Torah matters, the man has the final say if you cannot agree. I'm not talking about the woman's Torah matters, like menstrual law and kashrus, the kitchen, and that. I'm talking about other Torah matters, the man has the final say, and in anything what's called mili d'shmaya, practical matters, the woman has the final say. It's the most fantastic system. If you have a division of authority, you can't argue, right? Men have to know that. That means the woman has got the final say about the home. If you marry a girl who wants purple walls with yellow spots, you love it. You love it. That's her say, how the children are dressed, the house, it's a point, but that's all her. You've got no right to interfere. Don't enter the kitchen. You've got no business in the kitchen. It's irrelevant what she cooks. Whatever she cooks, you love. Right? So That you have to understand. Whereas the final authority halachically, the man has. This is a fantastic way of arguing. Of course, there are things that need to be agreed. Money, for example. Money is the classic area of explosive tension in marriages. And it has to be sorted out beforehand. You have separate expense, separate accounts. If you're going to draw from the same account, it's absolutely inevitable that you'll overspend. The credit card will go beyond what you kind of think. And you have the Gemara says, when tension, financial tension enters, then peace in marriage leaves. So you have to agree beforehand how that works. Also, I must mention that you need a rabbinic arbitrator. There's no question. You need a rabbi. You need a rabbi. You need somebody you look up to who's got wisdom, who's broad-minded, who's got experience of life, who knows you both, who knows the problems of your background and whether you're more frum than your family or not, all the issues. And you go to him. And with the tension in your home about kashrus, about Shabbos, about whatever it is, a personal issue, somebody you both agree to trust, and that person can arbitrate. It's wonderful. It just takes the tension out of it deflates and diffuses many potential arguments. So those are sorts of areas where compatibility is really a mistaken sort of thing. It's well known that marriages have crashed on the most trivial issues. Trivial issues. Just, you know, I'll give you an example. It happens to be personal, but I'm sure you can handle it. I personally married a girl. Well, let me put it this way. I am very organized. I like to be organized. I put things the same way. I'm like, my father trained me. My father was a very talented at surgery. And he trained me in a certain way. When I put things down, I put them in the same way. I like to know, if I reach out in the dark for it, like when you're operating, you know, you want an instrument that's going to be there, right? That's how I do it. I'm the kind of guy, I like to know that there's a fire in the house and I'm rushing out in the dark. The keys will be exactly where I left them. And that's how I live. Now, I married a girl, bless her, who never puts the keys in the same place twice. Okay? But not only that, she has the most amazingly creative places that she can think of putting keys. But not only that, she always knows where they are. That's what's really frustrating. So, like, there's nothing ever in... Like, you know what that can do to you? That can drive you absolutely, totally, screamingly psychotic. So how do you handle a situation like that? So when we got married, I got my own set of keys, right? She doesn't know where they are. I have my own keys, and I keep them where she doesn't know, right? And I don't tell her, right? I don't tell her. I've got my own pen, my own scissors, my own sticky tape, you know. I keep it all hidden. And that's how my marriage survives. So you see, you got to compensate for each other. You got to know that we are not compatible in that area. But that's it. I'm an organized sort of a guy. She's an artist, you know, and she's like creative. So she's very creative about where she puts the keys. Okay, you know, fine. That is how it works. So you have to have these sort of allowances. The Chofetz Chaim says you should have a Shalom Bayis fund. £100 a month. £100 a month for all the money she wastes. So she doesn't switch off the lights. Okay. So are you going to crash your marriage going to screaming heebie-jeebies because she doesn't put off the lights? Or are you going to say, that's within my £100 budget this month. She left the lights on. She doesn't put them off. You have to have a little more mature approach to your individual differences. So compatibility of taste is not an issue. There's also the issue of cultural compatibilities. We have seen that relationships that people think are going to be good, sometimes there's a cultural issue that's not so good. This is a very, very broad area, of course, but we have seen that there's certain cultural mixes that tend, after marriage gets going, to have certain issues. For example, I would say an English boy or an American boy with a Israeli girl from a secular background, right? That often presents issues. Why? Because girls who've grown up in Israel in the secular mold are extremely independent-minded, right? They've grown up in a very assertive, independent... How do you handle a girl who, you know, who has a submachine gun? You know, I mean... carefully, I suppose. The point is that you know, that is a cultural mix that whereas, for example, a man, an American or an English boy or South African boy, marrying a South American girl or a European woman often works very well, because South American women and European women very often have a natural sense of their own femininity and they don't need to assert it in any way. It often works very well. Whereas certain American girls, particularly from, let's say, wealthy New York backgrounds, they may have a more feminist sort of an outlook. It can, although these are very general type of statements, people do have different cultural heads. People from Southern California see the world differently than people elsewhere. I once had a girl at my Shabbos table, and in the middle of the meal, she leaned over and she said, "Rabbi, can you make a blessing on seeing a spiritually beautiful person?" So I said to her, "Are you from California?" She said, "Yeah, how do you know?" So people do have different cultural heads, and that can be important. There's a very good book on the subject of postmarital compatibility. That's called The River, the Kettle, and the Bird. It's an excellent book, and it warns you about many of the issues that people don't realize after they get married will set themselves up as misunderstandings, because male and female are different modes, and the different things that each take for granted and take for granted after you get married. That's a very important book that can defuse a lot of the problems. There's much more to say, of course, but are there any questions on anything we raised this evening that I can answer?
Even in very religious communities, there are unprecedentedly high levels of divorce. Would you like to say something about the issue of pre-signed get and prenuptial agreements?
I'm not knowledgeable enough about that. There's a lot of halachic research going on now, particularly in the States, about various forms of antenuptial sort of undertakings, right? Not so much a pre-signed get. I mean, that really sounds disastrous to me. What kind of marriage is that? You know, really preparing for our, you know, dissolution. But the interesting baseline fact here is that normative Jewish marriage already has that. You know, the ksuba is a marital document that assures the woman of financial independence in the case of his divorce or death. And the Talmud says one of the reasons that he commits himself to her like that financially is to make divorcing her unattractive. So she has financial security from that perspective. The ksuba is designed to do that. But there's a lot of modern research going on about the problem, of mainly directed by the feminist sentiment that has stimulated a lot of awareness and pain about the issues of women who are left unable to remarry because the husband hasn't given them a get, so-called agudas. By the way, I just point out to you that people don't know this, but it applies in both directions. It isn't only a woman who can't get married if the man won't give a get. It's the man who can't get married if the woman won't accept it. Do you know that the very same rabbis who the women accuse, modern women often accuse, of not being concerned about their welfare and allowing them to be in a situation where they can't remarry, those very same rabbis enacted a rabbinic law that a man's not allowed to divorce his wife unless she willingly accepts the get. I have a friend who for many years couldn't get married because his wife refused to accept the get. For many years he tried to get married and she would not accept the get. She kept him chained. Unfortunately for her, she died after a while and he was thereby set free. But this works in both directions. I'm not an expert at that. You can look it up. There are many who have researched this. There are a lot of halakhic publications on it. That's beyond my expertise. Anything that I can answer? Okay. This was a summary of an introduction to some of the issues of the wonderful mitzvah of getting married and how to find your personal victim.